Welcome to the AngelPool.org conference call. This is Michael Price of CEO Ventures. I serve as the 2011 volunteer chair of AngelPool.org, and I'll be moderating today's call. We have an excellent panel today, which will be discussing due diligence, what matters, and best practices. First, before we begin, some quick housekeeping announcements. Everyone is currently in mute. A number of questions were submitted in advance that we'll work our way through, but if you have any burning questions during the first part, please press star 6 to unmute your mic and go ahead and ask your question. And please just barge in. Don't be shy, as it's typically a fairly loud group. Then just press, please, after you ask your question, please press star 6 again after asking so that the background noise does not get out of hand. After the panelists' remarks, I'll then remind everyone how to unmute their phones to ask questions again. Just remember to hit star 6 right after, again, to reduce the background noise. For those joining the call for the first time, AngelPool.org is an organization of volunteer leaders who help angel groups across North America and is dedicated to helping their leadership build strong angel groups in their cities to drive jobs, innovation, and exciting new companies. For those angel groups that need additional capital to complete a seed round or that would like access to more deal flow, the Angel Pool Syndication Network is now the world's largest, providing easy monthly access to a large number of other angel groups and deals within their region. This also provides the members of each angel group total visibility into all the best deals in their region. AngelPool.org also organizes knowledge and educational events like this one to share best practices and lift each other's angel skills and knowledge. This ensures each angel group and their angels better fulfill their missions of helping entrepreneurs be more successful so that our portfolios, in turn, will also be more successful. With that, let's go ahead and begin. Today's topic, again, is due diligence, what matters, and best practices. The panelists are Birmingham Angel Network, Joshua Watkins in Birmingham, Louisiana Angel Network, Terry Jones in Baton Rouge, North Coast Angels, Todd Fetterman in Cleveland, and myself, Michael Price, CEO Ventures in Atlanta. And I'll ask each panelist to briefly introduce themselves first to the group for a quick minute, and then we'll begin the panel discussion. So, Josh, can I put you on the line?
Sure. Yes, Josh Watkins. I'm the executive director of the Birmingham group, which is a volunteer position. We've got about a 45-member group in Birmingham that's, I guess, 3.5 years old now, and I'm a corporate securities law lawyer by day and executive director of this group by night, but I'm certainly in and around all this on a very regular basis.
Okay, very good. Thank you. And then Terry Jones?
Hi, Terry Jones. I'm executive director of the Regional Innovation Organization down here in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and the Louisiana Angel Network is actually being evolved into a new angel fund, which I am have the great joy of being able to pull that together. So we're in the process of shifting to another new fund down here in Louisiana.
Okay, very good. And Todd Fetterman with North Coast Angels.
Todd Fetterman, executive director of North Coast Angel Fund. We are organized as a contributed capital fund, so we have two specific legal entities now. They each have 99 members, one $5.5 million, the other is $8.5 million. And over the past 5.5 years, we've invested in 26 companies, all early stage, technology oriented, so bioscience, advanced materials, IT software.
Okay, very good. And just an environmental comment, and Todd had brought this up. We'll be addressing our comments primarily as due diligence from an angel group perspective, but there should still be plenty of ammunition that's useful and helpful for the individual angels who might not be part of a group. And also in terms of the stage, it seems that most of us do have a formal screening committee that first weeds them out. So we're talking about due diligence kind of after that process of screening out, and probably even after they've pitched the members. Although in a couple of cases, such as the Birmingham Angel Networks, apparently they've got a mentoring committee that might dig in much sooner. So with that, we're going to attack this in several different sections. We're going to be attacking it on corporate materials, on IP, assets and liability, the product or service itself in terms of diligence, financial assets and liabilities, human resource assets and liabilities, material contract assets and liabilities, And finally, last but not least, to Obama and crew, tax assets and liabilities. So with that, on the corporate materials, and by the way, for the group, there's a very helpful checklist that you can access very easily. You can simply go to angelpool.org/diligence, and that's just one L. Again, angelpool, as in swimming pool, angelpool.org/diligence, and you'll see the list that we're actually going to be working off of today. And just working down that list. But obviously, first and foremost are the articles of incorporation or formation and bylaws. And by the way, for the panelists, please feel free to jump in at any point and discuss stories or interesting things that have happened. I'm aware of one with regard to articles of incorporation formation and bylaws that actually took place in Cleveland. This is not fortunately this is not Todd's North Coast Angel Fund. It was another who shall remain anonymous. But in any case, they did not pick up during their due diligence the fact that there was a voting trust in there that had the ability to make the votes. And in any case, when they put their money in, unrealizing that this trust existed on the vote side, they just conducted business as you normally would. The entrepreneur, unfortunately, just turned out not to be a great fit with the board. It turned out to be quite incompatible for unknown reasons. But in any case, they decided to make a change at the top, and they proceeded to terminate the CEO, and in fact, did literally terminate him, and I think they even had a sheriff who helped walk him and escort him out of the building, proceeded along. The CEO, of course, was not thrilled about having been tossed out of his company, collected his attorneys, and as they started reading through the agreements, they realized that they had all the voting rights for the company. And so at the next board meeting, they went ahead and voted, one-sidedly, I assure you, to toss out all the angels who had, all the board seats and the chair of the board. And that one that one turned out not to be at all as the angels had expected. So really have to dig in there carefully with a fine tooth comb. And let me turn it over to my fellow panelists. Any surprises in the articles of incorporation or formation or bylaws or any of the minutes that turned out to have a different effect than intended?
This is Todd. I'll jump in. We are never surprised to be surprised anymore. Many of the companies that we're looking at are very early stage, and oftentimes we're the first fund that has made an investment. There may be individual angels that have made an investment, but we're the first fund. And, that creates, I think, problems and opportunities. On the opportunity side, I'd say more often than not, we start with a clean slate and we'll establish a new articles of incorporation. Sometimes it's set up not as a double RC. We'll take the advantage to clean things up, clean up a balance sheet where it needs to be. But oftentimes the entrepreneurs have been so focused on the business and there's been so little structure that frankly it's just easier to start over than it is to dive in to existing documents. So oftentimes it's less expensive legally as well to start over from a clean set of documents that we all know and are comfortable with. And the challenge there is getting a heads up on the way in of knowing who has to sign off to adopt a new set of articles. So we would run into the same issue that you mentioned, and it is important to understand who's in the deal and who has what type of rights. Unfortunately, sometimes the entrepreneur is the CEO, and they don't have a full understanding of what they've signed in the past.
And that's very interesting. Have you all developed a model set of docs for that purpose?
We have.
Okay, very, very good. Have any of the others scrapped the entrepreneurs in docs and injected their own?
We do. This is Josh with the Birmingham Group. We typically do the same thing as well. We have a standard set of documents, and we'll we will almost always restate the operating agreement, the articles of incorporation, and make sure they comply with what we want to be there.
Yeah, that makes a whole lot of sense. And any other words of advice or wisdom regarding articles or bylaws? Very good. Let's move on into another real problem area, and I guess this oftentimes gets nixed if you're inserting your own standardized articles and bylaws. But if everyone can talk a little bit about options, voting trusts, warrants, put calls, subscriptions, convertible securities, all kinds of traps can be buried within those documents. Any surprises through the years that were are particularly noteworthy?
I'd say one of the more regular surprises we tend to see on that front are some of the terms that are attached to convertible notes. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes entrepreneurs will view convertible notes very favorably because they presume that the valuation will be exponentially higher, and it's in their best interest to defer the actual valuation. A lot of investors like them because they know oftentimes that's not the case, and they like to be first in line. But oftentimes individual investors can request what we consider probably non-market terms, discounts that are so generous that at the right market valuation, they essentially destroy all the value that the entrepreneur had. So that's something that we look at pretty quickly up front to try to understand if, in fact, that is realistic or if, in fact, the entrepreneur has to have a hard conversation with his investors and talk about a more modest upside to that convertible debt.
Mm-hmm. This is Jerry Jones. I would definitely agree with that. The overhang sometimes can be a tremendous problem. And I would actually back that up one step to say that it's not only within the options, the warrants, but literally in the first issuances of stock themselves, that they, as we all know, the entrepreneur backs themselves into a corner with a great valuation for them. That when something more along the lines of true fund institutional type money begins more sophisticated comes to the table, the guys that were in first all of a sudden are staring at much lower valuations, and if it's stock, they're staring at a cram down, which no one wants to see. But that's we're busy trying to educate people way out on the front end, so that there's a little bit more sophistication going into a deal, so that we don't see those problems down the line.
Yeah, I'd like to echo that the valuations that are somehow attached to these companies when they go out soliciting family, friends, and fools, can be shocking. And I can't tell you how many deals I've seen through the years get scuttled, just because of the the pride of the CEO not wanting to go back to their family and friends that bought very early on and saying, well, maybe 60 million might have been a little bit high on a starting valuation, and we might have to taper that down a bit. And sometimes pride gets in the way of coming down to a more certainly a more realistic pre money. And I'd like to echo.
Others don't have any ego.
And I'd like to echo the convertible securities and warrants. I've never not been surprised, I don't think, by what I find when we open up the kimono and take a look at those convertible securities and warrants. Just a curiosity, I put the question to the panel. Have many of you unwound some of those convertible securities and warrants as terms of the deal, and how's that perceived, and how do you deal with that issue in a non-confrontational manner?
This is Josh. We unwound two in, I guess, the last couple of months. It's always tough, we're so early stage. I mean, our group is typically either very early revenue or pre-revenue, so we're usually talking about the first round of investors, and especially the first-time entrepreneurs, it's not uncommon. Oklahoma that they've really gotten things goofed up. And so I think we tend to be pretty heavy-handed about coming in and saying, you didn't do this front-end piece right. Here's what you should have done. Get it fixed, and then we can come in. And but done with tact, you know, it has probably a 50-50 success ratio.
And I guess one thing that does help is, after all, they are family and friends, right? So, you know, at least they're approachable, you know, if they can just get the pride behind them.
Sure.
Very good. Any others had to frequently unwind, or any war stories in unwinding?
I wouldn't say frequently, but a tactic that I guess has been helpful for us just to be more effective when we find ourselves in that situation is to ensure that the valuation that we're talking about is fully diluted and that the convertible warrants, the convertible notes, rather, are part of the pre-money, not part of the post-money. Mm-hmm. So if we're setting the stage in that way, it essentially, you know, creates a zero-sum game between the entrepreneur and the convertible notes. It gives the entrepreneur a very strong incentive to be an advocate and get it right. And, you know, we also try to just point out that the lower the valuation is in the better interest of the note holder. So, you know, they would be whole, essentially, by giving up their conversion premium at a lower valuation with keeping it at a higher valuation. So as long as I think everybody can be happy getting a good deal and not feel the need to get an amazing deal, it usually works out.
Very good points. Any other comments on that general topic? All right, let's move over to intellectual property, assets and liabilities. You know, one of the ones that we listed was source code location, you know, condition, platform, code quality. I know a lot of us do, you know, tech deals, and, you know, more often than not, you know, software is in there. Even if it's a hardware deal, you know, you've got, you know, firmware in there. Just out of curiosity, for the group, how do you handle the due diligence on the code, you know, when you're taking a look at software? I'm just curious.
Well, this is Terry Jones, and that's where we kick in advisors. At the next level, if you know, advisors such as I have several advisors that in specific areas, we've got a guy that is our technology. It's a national level technologist, and when we really are deciding that this is something worth looking at, we kick them in. Either that advisor will serve in the capacity of an technology audit, or we'll look to once we pass through, it is at least brief fire. And it's still standing, then we'll move on to that audit phase, and we'll use him or we'll use some others that we can be go-to for us for those technology audits.
Okay, very good. Any other comments with regard to somehow assessing the quality of the code?
At North Coast, I would say this is probably one of our weaker areas. I think it's pretty hard for an angel group to do this well. You know, we perform pretty light technology audits, and if anyone feels like they've cracked the code on how to do that, we're certainly all ears, but it's difficult with limited resources and people in our network we have to feel like we've really done the right job there.
Yeah, and I think this is one that you know, we struggle with as well, and I'm sure that, you know, 9 times out of 10 we don't take frightening, but oftentimes we don't even take a look at that source code, which I'll deny in public. But in any case, it is what it is. Any other comments on source code and software diligence? One thing, you know, I think all of us do, without question, though, is obviously, you know, watch the web demos and try to spot bugs from the user's, you know, interface. But a lot of more sophisticated buyers, whether it be SAP or Oracle or whoever might come in and swoop in to buy it, you know, obviously that's one of the first things they'll ask for. And, you know, I know that we give it inappropriate emphasis during our due diligence.
Yeah, this is Terry again. I my background is DC. I think I probably didn't really say anything about my background. I've run my own fund, purely my own fund, True VC, and I guess I just brought that bad habit with me. I brought it right on down into the angel stage of deals. I actually have a complete advisory board, which, interestingly, sometimes when I'm talking to other angels, angel groups, they actually like that idea. It really helps give you a much higher level view and a good in-depth, quick look from someone that's got expertise. For example, I've got an MIT scientist, a former PhD guy from MIT that's for engineering, scientific issues. I've got a former Clinton healthcare advisor as another advisor, and I can't tell you how valuable having those type of relationships, those people that you can go to, and they can quickly vet something out, give you some additional input. It really can speed the process of the screening and determining what's real, what's not. And like I said, I just brought that on down into this range with me.
Okay, very good, very 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 helpful. All right, let's move on to the topic of patents. Evaluating patents, the worth of the patents. How are those patents protectable? Should the entrepreneur get a patent? Should we force them as terms of the deal to convert the provisional? All of those topics. I don't think I've ever been to a entrepreneurial education session where they asked how important were patents in our decisions, and how much attention we spend on them. So with that, maybe we go around, Robin. I'd just be very curious, from the panelists in terms of how they diligence patents.
This is Josh. I'll jump in. We don't. That's something that we've talked about fairly explicitly. But there are a number of resources that we can use, but other than that, sort of a live scrub. Internally, for all practical purposes, we don't. And I think our groups, we attempt to bake that into valuation of an early stage deal and understand that may on occasion bite us, but it's not cost effective to really appropriately dive into it with folks that know what they're talking about.
Yeah, makes sense. Others?
This is Terry. We obviously it depends on the type of deal that you might be looking at as to how important the IP is. A life science deal, it is the deal. Over on a technology side, used to be that was important, and now it's oftentimes it's a land grab. So. Technology that's good and an IP, if you even have a patent right now, 6 months from now, it'll probably be worthless. Things move so rapidly. So on the technology side, we don't focus really near as much on IP. Sometimes there's proprietary code, et cetera, that is important. So we do pay attention, but we don't do technology plays just because we see IP or we stay away because there's not. Patents aren't as key there.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah, we probably tend to look very lightly at the IP on the technology side. It's a nice to have, but we usually go into the diligence assuming that regardless of what the company's told us, there is no meaningful IP. Mm-hmm. That either the claims are going to be too aggressive and they'll never be issued, or they're going to be so soft that they'll be issued and won't be meaningful. It's usually one of those two. The bioscience side, our first look is just to try to see if something is blocking it. Usually by the time we've talked to an entrepreneur, they've done an informal freedom to operate. They've looked at whether it is in the space and are pretty well able to talk us through that. And we always determine who their IT counsel is and have at least a high-level conversation with them. It's a challenging conversation because you can talk for 20 minutes and realize you haven't heard anything. But it's helpful if they'll share with you their thinking, what other technologies they looked at, what they felt, was a prior art that was tangential and maybe helpful. You really never get anything out of them of saying what they were worried about they might be infringing on, but it's a conversation that we feel we can only learn from.
Okay, very good. That's very helpful. You know, after exiting a bunch, you know, I'm always cognizant of the all the conditions and you know the ways the acquirers can grab funds back that they've paid you. You know, if there are violations or perceived violations to any you know patents out there. So I do tend to spend an hour or two logging into the USPTO.gov site and hunting around and seeing what we find. I have not, to the point of the others, actually, outsource that to a law firm that could probably do a far better job than me, mostly because of, I guess, two factors. You know, one is the expense, of it to be actually done well versus the value that we might get out of it. And I guess the second piece is if that, if their, product or process is ever, patent is ever challenged, could that startup defend it in patent court? And the answer, is probably no. At least for the ones that we often see. If Motorola or if SAP decided to challenge that patent, they would not have the funds to go defend that in the patent courts. And so, to Todd's point, we do kind of devalue any patents to near zero in terms of value. And you can always hope and cross your fingers that they will be worth more than what the value that you're assigning to them. All right, any other comments on patents or trademarks? All right, very good. Let's get into let's talk about the diligence on consulting agreements, work for hire agreements, or agreements regarding inventions. Any comments there?
But I think, as in general, with all contracts and agreements that the company has, including what I may have missed, but didn't get said in the last one, it's not uncommon to have licensing of university technologies IP. It's crucial to know what those are, know what they say. And quite frankly, if they don't say what they really need or what you think they should, we don't have qualms about going back to the entrepreneur and saying these need to be redone, and we'll pitch in and help in that negotiation, for example, with the university to renegotiate licensing agreements. But bottom line for us is if there are bad agreements in place, they need to be fixed or we're not going to come in.
Any other comments on that topic? I've got a couple on my end that I found through Hard Knocks. When the acquirer comes in, let's say that company's successful and you can actually get it to an early exit, and it's time for the acquirer to come in and do their due diligence. Very often they will take a look at who actually did the programming. And they'll ask the inevitable question, do you have clear rights to this IP? Do you have formal documents conveying that intellectual property from those employees? And especially work for hire agreements. I can't tell you how many deals I've seen go south where they outsourced the programming to perhaps maybe an Indian team or Belarusian team or something of that nature, and they did not get assignments of technology signed by that outsourced team, and unless they've got that, the holdbacks on the transaction are going to be really, really steep on the acquisition. And so for before we fund a deal, anyone who's ever touched that code, we insist that we get them to formally sign an assignment of technology, whether it be consultants, whether it be work for hire, outsource, whatever. And we even take that all the way down to the employee level, even if they're working full time. I've seen one. There was one horror story where a company was being acquired. And right before the closing, one of the programmers said, you know what, I did most of this after hours and weekends, and I didn't get any extra pay for it, and therefore I feel I've got a claim to that IP. And that just brought that deal to just a screeching halt. So, you know, before we get involved, we even have the employees themselves, sign an assignment of the technology. Anyone who's touched that or conceived it or anything of that nature, because I've just seen so many deals get hung up when you're just within eyesight of that early exit. I mean, they are almost to the point of wiring the funds. And then that issue just, I've seen that crops up so many times, and so we just kind of insist upon that. Any thoughts on that topic?
That's a great point.
I'd echo that. We definitely do that, and it's one of the very first things we ask for, just because oftentimes it's one of the longest things to actually get back, and it can highlight problems before we get too involved.
Exactly.
I think anyone who's planning on being difficult has the most leverage right before a deal closes.
Exactly.
It's usually helpful right out front to get all the employees and anyone who's touched the code to sign off.
Yeah.
So also part of the employee sign-off is just verifying what their common stock or option pool ownership is, because we've never seen it, but I've heard the horror stories also where somebody was promised 10% of the company when it was just three people, in one guy's back office, and that was never formalized, but one person remembers it, one person doesn't, never makes it on the cap table, and then it's a big issue when the reps and warranties get discussed. Or if a VC comes to the deal, they just won't do the deal because it's too much hair for them.
That's interesting. So do you have do you canvass the early team, or you literally have them sign off that that they don't have any additional stock or warrants or promises other than what is laid out in front of them?
Yeah.
That's smart. Very good. Any other discussions in that area? This next one, B7, important technical know-how and methods used to protect trade secrets. And also, we found that it's also very important to know who. And, even though we might do an assessment of the technology and the software, typically there's still, for whatever reason, in many of the deals that we do, a lot of process that revolves around that technology. So, yes, we might have done a good job documenting what technology and what it does, and that that the company has clear title to that. But a lot of times, a key component is that know-how around and processes around it that you don't realize how important it is until that person leaves or gets disgruntled or something happens, and then suddenly you've got a nuclear event where the company can barely even service its customers. Any war stories or thoughts along that topic?
Hi, this is Terry. I had a deal once that unfortunately I wasn't in it yet. I was in a due diligence phase of it, but it was very heavily oriented towards some code programming and gas chromatographs, actually, and the software for them. And the owner, the entrepreneur, had a couple of programmers that were working with him. One of the programmers took off back over to Eastern Europe for like a month and a half, with the owner not realizing that he had not cataloged and put into safe backup and storage and just general organization where all the code was that he'd worked on. It was just always transferred right down into the boards. And lo and behold, guess what happened? A week after that guy took off and couldn't be reached, he had code issues. He literally had himself paralyzed for the next 5 weeks trying to sort out and figure out where the problem was. So not only is it just kind of a good safeguard for the other things you just mentioned, but literally for the operation of the company. It was unbelievable that he let that happen, but it happens probably far more often than people think.
Yeah, good thoughts. Any other thoughts on that topic? All right, let's move on. Let's go into product or service assets or liabilities. In C1 of that checklist is existing products or services and products or services that are under development. And I probably should have underlined and bolded under development, because I can't tell you how many times we've seen a situation where we go in, we fund a company, we have a pretty good feel for their current technology, right? Because we've seen demos, you know, all the Angel Group members have seen demos, the stuff works, the stuff's good. But unbeknownst to us, the chief engineer or one of the minions, you know, might have done 80% of the coding, you know, actually has in their mind the next generation version of it. And you know, sure enough, they leave you know, shortly afterward, and you know, suddenly this next, you know, cool version that is differentiated enough that it, you know, can, you know, get around some of the legal protections that we may have as part of that IP, you know, suddenly surfaces, or maybe it just comes under a different company, and we suspect that minion programmer might have had a hand in it. We can't prove it. It's just so frustrating. So we really try to make them document everything and anything that they might be working on under development, even if it's not released, even if it's not even the primary reason we're doing the deal. We really make them document their under development you know, products or conceptions. Any thoughts there on that topic?
I think that goes, part of that might be solved by, I'm not quite sure which gentleman just mentioned it back up in the IP section, but, you know, having the employees sign documents that make sure you know where the IP lies, who owns it, who has rights, definitely helps there. And I would say that, that this due diligence of the under development, it can do what you just said, Michael, but not only that, it also, one of the things that we find is, with the entrepreneur, they're sometimes not laser focused, and they begin to be distracted by these other opportunities and potentials. And, so sometimes it's, you know, it's a negative to discover just exactly how much of the under development is actually underway, meaning that their focus is too broad. They need to be refocused back down to, you know, the core.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Any other thoughts or comments on that? Very good. Another item here in C4, results of all studies and data on products or services existing or under development. You know, I can't tell you how many times we've seen. You know, has anyone ever seen a projection that is flat, or just shows mild growth for the next 4 or 5 years? Because if you ever have, you know, please send that to me so I can frame that thing. But in any case, I can't tell you how many times we've done an investment, and they show great trend lines in growth, but then. A few months later, it surfaces that a study had been done before funding showing that the customers thought the product or service stunk. And it's always interesting to try to ferret out all those studies beforehand so you can go in with your eyes wide open. Anyone been surprised by internal studies or information on the assessment or marketability of their products that didn't surface until maybe after the funding? All right, very good. Another particular item is unfilled orders. We really take a look at unfilled orders closely and ask them to document any unfilled orders. That also oftentimes points out bottlenecks in their system, and it's really helpful for us to determine pain points that would prohibit them from scaling. Any things that each of you look at on the panelists in terms of, you know, when you're checking out and diligencing the product or service that you feel is particularly important?
Go ahead.
This is Todd. We just found it
through the plan, ask, you know, how you're going to do it, why you're going to do it, what else you're going to need, and try to make sure that they're comfortable explaining it, and then to dig into each step. I think sometimes we find areas that aren't necessarily glossed over intentionally, but just have not required that much time and effort for them to look at yet, and they should have. So, for example, we have one hardware-software play where there's a new technology which is being outsourced to China. And there has been a alarmingly little time and energy paid to understanding whether or not the company could really deliver in the 45 days that they thought, talking to other people who've used them. You know, it was kind of a glaring, probably one of the top three reasons the whole thing could have blown up, right, if they could not have delivered the quality and quantity and timeliness that they promised. But there was not a lot of diligence done on that. But I don't think we would have come across that unless we had just sat down for hours and talked through the various components of the plan to see what the CEO is comfortable with, what they were not comfortable with, and what they were working on personally versus what they had outsourced to others. Oftentimes what they outsourced to others may not have received that time and attention, but the CEO has not necessarily looked back on it to understand where it stands.
Very good points.
Yeah, I think those are great points. The only thing I would add is that particularly when it comes to a widget, if that's what the product is, and any manufacturing, anything that you know, for the widget to come together, it relies on not only the internal and following the trail of the internal, but especially also the external, who are the outside providers. You know, we've seen deals, you know, get into serious trouble, fortunately, that we resolve them, but not until, you know, a good bit of time and money gets spent resolving them, following that outside trail and discovering problems with outside service providers or component providers.
Another thing I found very useful is insist that they explain any major customers lost, provides great insight in terms of bottlenecks and issues that might come back and really haunt that company down the road. But always found that to be extremely useful. Any other comments on product or services diligence? All right, financial diligence. That probably goes beyond the scope of this particular call because there's so many things to look for there. But obviously, you see all the basics in that checklist. One of them, of course, inventory and physical assets. It's amazing how pieces of expensive equipment tend to disappear when you most need them. HR. Can you each describe anything that you do in particular on the HR side in terms of due diligence?
This is Terry. We make it a practice to interview not just the main person, whether that is the central founder or not. We interview all key management and want to spend time with each of them to make an assessment of the total team, and to the extent of the size of the company that true HR issues might begin to come into play, then we'll begin to delve into those HR issues.
Very good.
This is Josh. I would say one of the things that we view as sort of a key value add for a lot of our group is, given that most of the companies that we invest in are fairly small teams when we invest in them, and quite often the HR scaling aspect of the business is something that it's not common for them to have a lot of experience in. So we do try to bring in some folks to flesh out that portion of the plan. Quite often it's somewhat underdeveloped. But from a due diligence standpoint, also because the teams are so small, I think we get at a lot of the HR potential issues really through getting to know the core team and walking through their various aspects of the operation, their responsibilities in depth.
Very good.
Yeah, this is Todd. I'd agree and just say that, you know, the HR component or getting comfortable with the key management team is really the common denominator to everything else that you do. So, you know, if we're paying attention, we'd like to think that as we're talking about the financials and IT and the market opportunity and all those details that we're learning about the entrepreneur as we go, we're, you know, not just learning do they have the skills requisite, the functional skills or the industry expertise, but also the appropriate skill set and demeanor to be a good entrepreneur. And there are a lot of people we see who come from big companies that have a certain perspective which may not be what's needed to be a strong entrepreneur. Everyone knows that the business plan changes several times as you go, that the more successful you are, the more capital you need, the more quickly you need to hire, the more quickly you need to change your plan. And it takes somebody with a high level of communication skills and flexibility and ability to deal with ambiguity to do that. So we try our best at all steps to size up whether or not the person who's the CEO in a senior management role can really manage a successful company, because it's pretty easy to play that role in a modestly successful company or a mediocre company. But to play that role in a company that really is experiencing high growth is a different cup of tea.
Makes sense. A couple of things we look at on the HR side is we always ask any material threatened or filed employee liabilities that be disclosed. The filed is fairly straightforward, and they feel kind of obliged to give that up. But any threatened ones, we find ourselves really pulling teeth to try to get that out. A lot of times the funding will cause a shift of the senior management team. If someone feels they contributed a certain amount and they're not getting their fair share, when it's time for stock allocation, if you're going to be rewriting the cap tables, we've seen that might either immediately or in the near term, cause one of the senior people to leave. And so anything threatened, anything that would create significant liability, we want to know about. Another thing, and this one's kind of an odd one, but we really take a look at accrued vacation pay and ask them to restate their vacation policies. It's kind of the rare startup that'll have very much quantified in terms of formal employee handbooks like everyone really should, but for whatever reason they get busy and they don't. And they also do a terrible job documenting any time they've taken off. And in fact, most just don't. And so if you've got a person that's been there for three years before you're about to fund the company, and suddenly they're leaving, we've seen situations where they're claiming 4 weeks per year times three years time in any case putting in claims for 40, 50 grand against the company that might have a shot when pushing gets to shoving with the HR lawyers. So we see that a lot, and so we typically will ask them to restate and sign off in terms of the amount of vacation pay accrued and things of that nature, so we understand the risk there. Any other comments with regard to HR due diligence? All right, let's get into material contract diligence. I think that's mostly self-explanatory, right? We just all need to really dig into those contracts. It's painful, it's slow, it's ugly, it's boring, but it just has to be done. Any war stories where you lost your left arm or saw another fellow angel lose their left arm from material contracts? Very good. Let's go into tax and asset liabilities. State sales tax returns for the last 3 years. I got burned on that one. I can make a comment there. Made investment into a company. I did not ask for state sales tax returns before I invested. Their financials looked perfect. It was just the perfect graph. Never saw a prettier graph of steady incremental quarterly increases in sales and increases in margins. Just such a beautiful thing. You just wanted to frame it. That should have been my first dead giveaway. Someone please slap me over the phone. But in any case, I hadn't checked sales tax returns. They hadn't filed them in a number of states. And the states don't take kindly to that. And that turned out to be just a monumental disaster in that particular company. Any comments by the group in terms of any tax diligence that you do?
I think it's important to do that due diligence. We've seen the same. We've seen companies that don't pay and haven't been reporting or paying sales tax, which, of course, is usually a tailspin sign, but occasionally it could be possible otherwise, but it spells a huge trouble either way.
We've seen companies behind on their payroll withholding, behind on workers' compensation requirements. And I think oftentimes they get a little behind, and it's easier to not make that payment than to not make other payments. I don't know that a lot of entrepreneurs appreciate what a bad idea it is to borrow money from the government, but that's essentially what you're doing, and you obviously are setting yourself up for all sorts of other issues. We've seen, at least one situation where we understood where they're coming from, we helped them to fix it, and we remained comfortable with the deal and move forward, and so far do not regret it, but there are plenty of other situations where that's been one of the red flags that has caused us to not be comfortable moving forward with the deal.
Okay, very good. Any other comments on that topic?
Go ahead. The tax credits, I would say that, everybody should be aware of any potential state incentives that either the angel or the entrepreneur, the startup, can take advantage of within their state. Because quite frequently we see companies that aren't taking advantage of the truly free dollars that can be significant dollars in some instances. So, even though programs are, supposedly promoted, there's still a lot of entrepreneurs that don't know about them. So we always try to make sure that we're taking full advantage of all state incentive programs.
Okay, very good. Another item on that list is G9, list of states or countries where property owned or leased or employees maintained or business conducted. That's another one where I've been burned on a particular occasion. This company didn't have any employees in California. They did have some, some contract employees that would just fly in for a day to do their business in California and then fly out. There were 1099s. Somehow, California and several other states are, I can't tell you how aggressive they are. And finding any way to dig their heels into you and figure a way to extort money, out of you. And they latched on to, that issue, challenged whether they were 1099 employees or not. They had a handy checklist where, it's nearly impossible to meet, all criteria to say that they're clearly 1099 employees. And then, went in and retroactively, invoiced, going back, 4 years. For employment taxes and all kinds of other creative things. Really, the sky was the limit in terms of their creativity. I was very impressed, but it just left a really foul taste in my mouth. Any others have been burned by aggressive estates like that?
I don't know if that's enough to make me be more careful the next time.
Yeah, we really watch out for that now. Spilled milk. And then, we're almost out of time. So the last category was legal, assets and liabilities diligence. We asked not only for any pending or filed litigation, but we also asked for any threatened litigation. We don't always get full disclosure like we should when we ask for that, but we found out that the hard way that of course threatened litigation leads to filed litigation eventually, unless it's 10-2 or the plaintiff feels they don't have a strong enough case. And have any of you ever experienced situations where there might have been threatened litigation where the where the president or CEO or the key people didn't fully disclose that to you?
This is Josh. I would say, you know, we've of course passed on, I imagine most of us have, a number of deals because of threatened litigation that, and it came up in the IP side, you know, quite often with startups in particular, even if the litigation is even credible, somewhat regardless of whether or not you might ultimately be able to win, you know, typically it's not worth the fight, and that quite often is enough to cause us to pass on to another deal. But I was going to say, you know, for all of these things, one of the, you know, we rely fairly heavily on the professionals that the group is already working with to be on top of their game. And so we also are somewhat aggressive in recommending changes to folks that we're more comfortable with. Prior to an investment to allow them to help us ferret out any issues that we may have missed. Probably a lot of these things that we don't look at as hard, but not because we haven't looked at as hard, but because we know there are experts that we trust involved, and you know, they have their obligations to stay on top of things as well.
Okay, very good. Any other comments on that topic? All right. Let's go ahead and spend a couple minutes wrapping things up. Everyone on the call today may listen to past events and participate in future events at no charge. You may see a full listing of future events at angelpool.org. Again, that's angelpool as in swimming pool, angelpool.org, and then clicking on the knowledge tab. There are a number of high-profile speakers and panels coming up that will be discussing various aspects of angel investing best practices. The next few events are on October 13th. There'll be Chris Dixon, founder partner of Founder Collective, speaking at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 Pacific. On October 27th, we're having another panel. The topic will be Future Hot Sectors, Skating to Where the Puck Will Be. That will, again, also be at 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 o'clock Pacific. For those of you in the South, on October 25th and 26th, there will be Venture Atlanta, which will be held in Atlanta. There will be an ACA Southeast Regional Meeting on October 19th in Charlotte, North Carolina. It will include sessions on valuations, innovations, syndications, and an update on the new ACA HALO reporting system to help us better track national angel trends and deal terms. There will be an ACA Northeast Regional Meeting on October 27th in New Haven, Connecticut. This event will feature syndication opportunities and a speaker in the first part of the day, followed by the Connecticut Innovation Pipeline Awards. Angels may attend both events with their registrations. Last but not least, the ACA Annual Summit will be held on March 6th through 8th in Austin, just before the famous South by Southwest Interactive Conference. There will also be a pre-summit programming by the Angel Resources Institute. If anyone has not attended an ACA summit, they are exceptional in both contacts and content. I cannot say enough good things about the last one I attended, which was held near MIT, this year. So I would definitely recommend that. I would like to really thank our panelists for sharing their thoughts with so many angels across North America today. Your involvement and dedication to entrepreneurism sets a new high benchmark for others to follow. On behalf of all the angel groups that were able to join us and those who will be listening to the recordings, we really appreciate your efforts. So, again, thank you both. Thank you, all three of you, so much. We really appreciate your taking the time with us today. So, Josh with Birmingham Angel Network, Terry down in Louisiana, and Todd up in Cleveland, thank you all very, very much for volunteering your time to speak to the panel today. All right. I think that the call was recorded and should be available. Normally it would be available same day, but I'm actually at a conference off-site, so it will be available Saturday. This call is now concluded. Thanks all, and have a great day. The conference is now ended.
Yeah, that's this. You're the only person still in the meeting. You can...